Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today will be Mitch Gruber. He is the Chief Strategy Officer at FoodLink, which is a nonprofit organization up in the Finger Lakes region, and we'll tell you about that in just a little bit when he comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the news, some ways that I hope you will take action so that we can keep our voice to being heard. And then, of course, I want to share with you my weekly recipe. So first, when it comes to taking action, right now there's we are sending toxic fire suppressant foam into landfills or into toxic processing places where they will burn the fire suppressant foam, which is very toxic. And of course, a lot of these places where they will be burning it are very close to communities that are already being hurt by social injustice and environmental injustice. And so this is just, you know, more of the same. But anyway, there is a petition on our website, and we're asking everybody to sign it, to sign the petition to prevent New York State from burning this fire suppressant foam anywhere in New York State. So please sign that petition for me. It's really important. There's also a petition on there to stop AntScammer, which is a an equity firm who is building a power plant right by Newburgh up the Hudson River, just, 100 miles north of, not even 100 miles north of New York City. And it is just completely against the passing of the climate law that we just passed in the spring. And we need to be moving all of our infrastructure towards renewable energy. And this AntScammer power plant is a fresh gas plant, and it's right on the banks of the Hudson River. And it is just not in the direction we need to go. And so we need people to sign the petition for that, and also for the Williams pipeline, which is still, believe it or not, in the works. So please take a look at those for me and sign them. Also on my website, I have some links for our local farmers, any small farmers. There's a farmer relief fund where you can get a small loan through the American Farmland Trust. And then there's also a payback protection loan program through the CARES Act that you can also participate in. And so these applications need to go in right away because it is a rolling fund. So you need to get your application in before the money runs out. So first come, first serve. So definitely get your money in. I have links on my website, but you don't want to waste time with that because it's really important. And I want to just check in. I hope everyone's doing okay with this COVID-19 pandemic. It's really turned our whole world upside down. I know, many people who have holidays coming up this week are going to be doing it in a very different way. I celebrate Passover and usually have a table of 30 in my living room. And this year we will be doing it virtually and trying to connect with our family through Zoom. So that should be interesting. There's Haggadahs that you can participate in online. I know it's also Good Friday and Easter, and that's going to be very different for people. So wherever you are and whatever your religious affiliation or if none, just stay safe, be smart, and share the love, because we need to share the love all the way around. So I want to share my recipe with you this week. This week, actually, my recipe is matzo ball soup. Traditional matzo balls are made with chicken fat, and the soup is usually a chicken soup. So this is a matzo ball recipe, which is a vegetarian matzo balls in a miso soup. And I even have a vegan option because the matzo balls, even though they're vegetarian, they do use eggs. So I do have a recipe that also does not have eggs. So I'm going to share both of them with you. And you can download this recipe on my website at ieatgreen.com. So the matzo balls with miso soup, for the matzo balls, you want to start with 4 eggs. This makes about 25 matzo balls, about golf-sized matzo balls. 4 eggs, 2 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon of white pepper, 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg, 4 tablespoons of coconut oil, 1 cup of matzo meal, and 4 tablespoons ice water. And you're going to start by beating the eggs, salt, and pepper, and nutmeg together in a bowl. Then add the coconut oil. And just a little tip here, the coconut oil, you want to make sure it's softened. Very often when you get a jar of coconut oil, it's really hard. And if you use the coconut oil right out of that jar, it's going to be lots of broken, hard pieces. So you can take an immersion blender and go right into the jar and just whip up that coconut oil a little bit before you use it so that it's smooth. So it has a similar consistency of chicken fat. So then you're going to add the coconut oil and mix it until it dissolves into little pieces. Gradually add the matzo meal to that. And then you're going to add the water, 1 tablespoon at a time, until it reaches the right consistency. And basically, I always end up using all 4 tablespoons of ice water, but that's up to you. And then you want to refrigerate this batter overnight, or at least for like 4 hours, in the refrigerator so that the coconut oil and the batter, the matzo meal has time to absorb the liquid and it gets to the correct consistency for the matzo balls. And then you're going to make matzo balls with it. It makes about 20 to 25 matzo balls. I use a little cookie scooper so that all the matzo balls are about the same size, but you can just, you know, freeform matzo balls with your hand if you'd like. And then for the miso soup, you're going to start with 12 to 16 cups of water. And in that, you're first making a vegetable stock. So you're going to add 2 onions cut in quarters. I wash the onions, but I leave the skin on because the skin gives it a nice color, a yellow color. Actually, onion skins are used actually in natural dyeing as well to get that yellow color. So then 4 parsnips peeled and cut in half, 4 carrots peeled, cut in half, 2 turnips washed, ends cut off and then put in, 2 sprigs each of parsley, sage, rosemary, thyme, and dill, 2 celery stalks, 5 cloves of garlic, 1 2-3-inch piece of ginger, and then you're going to have 2-3 carrots that you're going to keep on the side, and you're going to cut those into little, you know, diced mouth-sized pieces to add to the soup broth after you strain it. So those will be the carrots that will be in the soup. And you can also have 1/4 cup of chopped parsley on the side as garnish. And then 6-8 tablespoons of white and red miso. I like to combine the two, but you can, if you only have one, you can use that. I actually ran out of red miso and during this pandemic couldn't find any more, so I got brown rice miso, which also worked. So you're just going to fill a large pot with the 12 to 16 cups of water. Put in all those vegetables except for the 2 carrots that you're going to keep out to add to the final soup. And bring it to a boil and then lower it to a simmer and let that cook for about 2 hours until all the flavor comes out of those vegetables. And then you're going to strain out the soup. Keep a lid on it and keep it at a low simmer so that you don't evaporate too much of the broth. And you should have about 8 cups remaining. Then return the stock to a clean, large pot. Add the additional carrots and cook those just until the carrots are soft, about 15 minutes or so. You're going to remove 1 cup of the broth, and in a separate bowl, you're going to dilute the 6-8 tablespoons of miso with that 1 cup of broth. And I actually use a little immersion blender to just buzz it really quickly and get it blended together. But you can do it just with a spoon. And then you're going to add that mixture right back into the soup pot. One tip, though, is that all the live microbes that are in the and the bacteria that's in the miso, which is really good for your health, you do not want to ruin by boiling the soup. So once you add the miso into the soup, do not let the soup return to a boil. Just get it hot You can add the matzo balls to the hot miso broth to reheat the matzo balls. And that's it. And you're going to serve it with some chopped parsley. Now, if you want the vegan option, here's the recipe for the vegan matzo balls. 1 cup of matzo meal, 1/2 cake of silken tofu. And this is a 12-ounce package of tofu, not a 16-ounce package. So 1/2 cake is just 6 ounces. 3 tablespoons of coconut oil that's also softened. 3/4 teaspoon salt. 1/2 teaspoon baking powder. 1/4 teaspoon white pepper. 1/4 teaspoon nutmeg. 1 tablespoon of minced carrots and 1 tablespoon of minced onions. 2 tablespoons potato starch. 2 tablespoons bisan flour, which is chickpea flour. The juice of 1 can of chickpeas, which is now known as aquafaba, and 4 tablespoons of ice water. So you're going to puree the tofu. You can either use an immersion blender, a food processor, a mini food processor, any way you'd like to really blend up that tofu. And it's silken tofu, so it blends very easily. In another bowl, you're going to beat the aquafaba, which is the chickpea juice, until it's white and doubled in volume. And this is a way that vegans can have an egg replacement using this aquafaba. It beats up almost like egg whites. You can actually get peaks out of it. And so you're going to beat up the aquafaba. Then you're going to add the softened coconut oil, salt, pepper, nutmeg, baking powder, and pureed tofu all to that and mix that well. In another bowl, you can combine the matzo meal, the potato starch, and the bisan flour. Add the minced carrots and minced onions to that. And then you're going to add the wet ingredients to the whole thing and blend that up well. Then add the ice water, 1 tablespoon at a time. But again, you'll end up putting in the whole 4 tablespoons of the ice water. But just mix it after each addition. Cover it with plastic wrap and let that refrigerate overnight in the refrigerator. And then you're going to do the same thing as you did with the other matzo balls. You're going to remove it from the refrigerator, make little balls out of it. I, again, use my cookie scooper, which will make all the matzo balls about the same size. And these only have to cook for about 10 minutes, where the other matzo balls cook more like for 20 minutes. And when they're finished, you remove them from the water with a slotted spoon and let them cool down. When you first remove them, they appear a little slimy. I think that's from the potato starch, but that kind of goes away after it sits out for a little bit. And then when you add it to the broth, it's perfect. So enjoy it. If you have any questions, of course, you can always email me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Mitch Gruber. He's the Chief Strategy Officer at FoodLink. He's also a member of the Rochester City Council. FoodLink is the regional food bank of the Finger Lakes region, whose mission is to end hunger and build healthier communities through the power of food. Mitch is also a historian of urban food systems, and all of his work aims to build healthier, more equitable food systems. So welcome, Mitch, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for getting me excited for Passover coming up.
Ah, yes. Well, you have a lot of things to be excited about. I hear you just had a baby this past week.
I did. I had a pandemic baby. Speaking of having to adjust schedules for the Seder, we had to do a Zoom bris, which will hopefully never be a thing that has to happen again.
Oh my God! I just want you to know, it's the 5th baby in a circle of people I know. I've had a couple nieces that have had babies. A lot of babies this pandemic. It's amazing. Well, anyway, I'm glad you guys made it through and that you're healthy and at home and safe. So that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
So maybe you could just give us a little history about FoodLink before we get started. Like, when was it founded? How many people do you serve? What's your connection to Feeding America? And how does FoodLink work?
Sure. For a little bit of context, I'm sure most of your listeners have some familiarity with Feeding America, which right now is certainly getting a lot of national attention and buzz. But Feeding America is the large umbrella network of food banks. And every county in the nation has a food bank that is assigned to it. For FoodLink, we serve the 10 counties that are basically between Buffalo and Syracuse, all the way down to the Allegheny or to the Pennsylvania border. And we serve, you know, within that's about a 7,000 square mile service area. There's roughly 200,000 folks who identify as food insecure within those 10 counties. And a lot of what we do and what we've been doing as a food bank since 1978 is emergency food relief, which, you know, it's strange, Bhavani, that right now, since we spoke at the NOFA conference, where I basically made a pitch that food banks need to move away from just thinking about emergency food. Because of the pandemic, it has really been where our major focus has lied over the last month. But food banks are places that essentially take in abundant food throughout the food system and get it out to food pantries, soup kitchens, homeless shelters. Foodlink in particular has a reputation as one of the more progressive food banks in the nation, and that's due to our founder, Tom Ferraro, and the vision that he set out, and the fact that we have always really tried to make sure that charitable food was not the sole focus, but we were using it as a way to leverage the power of food in a much more holistic manner.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that when you say a more holistic manner? What makes it more holistic?
Yeah, so what Foodlink has really prided ourselves on over the past, I've been with the organization now for about 12 years, and I can say with certainty that what we've always done is try to push the envelope in terms of how we actually use our assets and resources. Tom's mantra was always that food banks need to be good stewards of resources, because we have millions and millions of dollars of not dollars, but infrastructure, coolers, freezers, trucks, inventory systems, so on and so forth. So at Foodlink, what we've done is we've established a pretty significant amount of programming that uses the infrastructure of food banks to do more. So I'll give you some examples. The perhaps the biggest one, what brought me to first talk to you at NOFA is the curbside market program, which is the largest mobile market in the nation when it comes to SNAP transactions. We do well over 50% of our transactions are folks using SNAP, and we're taking fresh fruits and vegetables and going around to affordable housing facilities, federally qualified health centers, YMCAs, and community centers, and actually just setting up markets in parts of the community that otherwise would never have a farmer's market. So that's one example, and I can give you a whole host of other ones, but I don't want to take away from your questions either.
Right, right. Yeah, the curbside mobile program sounds fascinating because you actually can go to where the people are. Because so often, what I hear so often is that people can't get to the farmers markets. You know, they don't have access to get there. And so by going to the communities where the food insecure live, you're really, you know, servicing what they need and where.
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, making, I think one of the most important mantras that anyone who's in the world of food access and public health needs to really consistently practice and preach is making the healthy choice the easy choice. I mean, I think at this point, what our medical community has done a very good job of is making it clear that diet is a very important part of someone's overall health, right? We know that. And in fact, I think now when you look at what's happening on TV and newspapers, there's more time dedicated to cooking and talking about eating healthy seems like it's getting more pressed than ever before. But it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to actually make it convenient for folks. And right now in most poor communities, like the one where I live and serve in Rochester, New York, the vast majority of individuals, the only convenient place to buy food is the corner store. And at the corner store, the only food that's available is overly processed, incredibly problematic foods that cannot be the foundation for a healthy diet. But the curbside market allows us to make the healthy choice the easy choice, not just by going where people are, but also by accepting SNAP benefits, by doubling SNAP benefits, and by working with nutrition educators to make sure recipes are available all the time.
Uh-huh. And how has the pandemic affected that? I know the curbside mobile program had to be closed down during this pandemic. How are you getting good food to these people now?
Yes, I mean it's a great question. It's a sad answer, which is that you know we as a food bank has to focus on the things that we knew that we can do in this pandemic that were the most vital. And so what that means is that we're doing two things as an organization right now. First is that we're preparing about 5,000 meals a day for students in the Rochester City School District, which sadly is one of the poorest school districts in the nation. And we wanted to make sure that that individuals could access breakfast, lunch, or a third meal or a dinner. If there are members of the Rochester City School District who now, of course, because school is closed, cannot access those meals. So we're doing that. And then the second thing we're doing is we're focusing on emergency food relief specifically for seniors, those who are medically quarantined, and those who have recently been laid off and don't know where the next paycheck is going to come from. So what that's meant is that we've had to take our curbside market, sadly, and we've had to redeploy that staff to make sure that we could do what we needed to do in this pandemic. But Bhavani, I think it speaks to the larger point, which is that food banks, I believe, and this was the message I tried to convey at NOFA too, food banks need to have a continuum of services, right? We need to figure out how to do both the upstream and the downstream work at all times. And right now, because of the nature of this pandemic and the unprecedented need that it's created in this community and beyond, we need to make sure that we're focusing on a particular part of that continuum, which is emergency food. But as soon as we're back to normal, the curbside market will be out there, and so will things like our nutrition education program, our culinary training programs, making sure to serve people in new and creative ways.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I noticed your deadline for the culinary program is coming up. How are you going to deal with that now that people can't really do that? Is it being extended or changed? And maybe actually this might be a good time to actually tell my listeners about the culinary program.
Yeah, sure. So this program is called the Foodlink Career Fellowship, and it is like the curbside market. It's a national model because it is the one, as far as we know, at least, it's the only culinary training program in the nation that is a 12-month paid apprenticeship. And the purpose of it is to work with individuals who have otherwise been boxed out of the job market, folks who may have a history of incarceration or substance abuse, or maybe they just don't have, or maybe just generational poverty, things that have prevented them from being able to get into the workforce and excel. We're taking those individuals and we're providing them with a pathway to get into the burgeoning food industry, specifically when it comes to culinary. And this is not intended to create entry-level jobs. We are working around the clock to help people get middle skills jobs, things like a line cook with a huge, huge ceiling. And we're working with some of the biggest employers in the region, Wegmans, University of Rochester, so on and so forth. And just before the pandemic, it's incredible. It feels like it was a year and a half ago, but it was only about probably about 45 days ago. We had the Lieutenant Governor, Kathy Hochul, into our facility at Foodlink to announce the unprecedented expansion of our training program so that we could have more apprentices than ever before.
How many do you normally take on?
So thus far we've had two cohorts. Each of them have been at about 8 to 10 people. Again, this is a very costly program because we are having folks be trained or paid for the entire year of their service. And now with the new expansion by New York State, we'll be able to run two cohorts per year of 15 people per cohort. So we can really get up to about 30 individuals per year, and the employers are so excited about this. So to answer your original question, Bhavani, what I would say is that we're still expecting to be able to run this training program we're still going to start recruiting next month with the hope of starting in July. And the reason for that is because we know that even though the restaurant industry right now is obviously a little bit, has been decimated by COVID-19, the reality is we still need there to be the next generation of cooks and culinarians. And as a matter of fact, places like Wegmans and the hospital systems, which are producing more food than ever before, they need more employees now than ever. So we're going to make sure that we can train those folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Now, I know one of the ways that you're dealing with the pandemic is you're making the meals for the school kids. One of my hats that I wear down here is I am the farm to school coordinator for a local public school. And we also are making meals for the kids during this time. One thing I was impressed with was when I went to your website, FoodLink, it talked about how you were really working with school meals to make them better and healthier. Can you share with me how you're doing that and how you're getting around some of the commodity foods that you are, you know, that you have access to for free, or whether you are still using all those commodity foods and just adding other things in?
Yeah, so FoodLink, in addition to being the food bank in town and running some of these innovative programs like the curbside market, we also have a commercial kitchen, which we really established with the sole purpose of trying to raise the bar on institutional food. And we obviously, you know, we've been proud recipients of a couple of different New York State Farm to School grants, and actually a USDA Farm to School grant. We're really doing everything that we can to make sure that more healthy food and local food is incorporated into our meals. One of the ways that we've done that is quite simply by hiring really talented chefs. And again, as I was just saying before, by training really talented chefs so that people have the skills to be able to look at a traditional school menu and innovate it and make sure that it's using more fresh and healthy product. One example that I love talking about is that we actually have an entire room in our kitchen dedicated to slicing apples. We are the only small-scale processor of sliced apples, as far as I know, in the region. And one of the reasons for that is because we know that Cornell actually did a study many years ago that showed that consumption rates go up in school children by more than 70% when you offer kids a sliced apple versus a whole apple. So that may seem like, what a strange thing to do, although I'm sure anyone who's ever worked with kids before knows it to be true. But yet nobody else is offering a New York State sliced apple as part of a school lunch menu. So we just decided to start doing it. We're buying apples from Wayne County Farms. We're washing them, slicing them, preserving them with citric with a product that is predominantly citric and ascorbic acid, and then we are getting them out to schools in 2-ounce serving sizes. So that's one example of how we are raising the bar on institutional food, getting kids a sliced apple packaged in a way they want it versus a whole apple that may wind up in the garbage can.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the sad thing again with COVID-19 is that I can't deny that the quality and diversity of our menus have had to change dramatically because we can no longer do hot meals right now. Everything that we need to do with our kitchen has to be grab and go food because we cannot and will not encourage congregating and communal meals, which is so, you know, it's one of the big challenges of right now, at least in my world and probably in many of your listeners' world too, is we've been spending all this time. I mean, I've spent 12 years now, both at FoodLink and at City Hall, talking through how we want people to think about things like slow food, right? And make food something that we're not just cramming the cheapest, quickest thing in our mouth, but really thinking about the way food makes us feel. And yet, because of the nature of COVID-19, we really have no choice but to kind of refute some of that logic and say, you know what, we have to do grab and go meals. That's all we can do right now. It's the most safe and responsible thing. So take this and go back to your home and eat it there. And what that's doing is it's limiting the different types of foods that we can actually produce during this pandemic. But someday I hope to be able to talk to you and your audience, even perhaps with our executive chef, to share some tricks and some of the trades. But when we have a more diverse and exciting menu than we do right now.
Uh-huh. Why is it not possible? And I wanted to know this too for our local school district. Why can't you still do some hot meals and just provide it to everybody cold and let them heat it up in their own homes? Is it because you don't think people have a place to heat it up, or you're concerned about it sitting out too long, or what's the thought behind that? You know, I'm thinking of like soups, and you know, why not give them a cold pint of soup and let them heat it up at home?
Yeah, it's both things actually. I mean, number one, the city of Rochester has some of the highest poverty rates in the entire nation, and I don't think it's particularly wise of us to assume that all the kids in the city school district are going to have access to a kitchen to be able to heat things up or the right equipment
uh-huh.
or things of that
mm-hmm.
nature. But the other piece is in fact food safety. You know, if we're doing things like meats and or various different things, dairy, whatever the case may be, that we have to be, you know, if under normal circumstances we would be temping things and following proper food safety protocols that way, without it in our under our control and supervision, it's just too much of a risk that it won't be done the right way. So that's why when it comes to kids meals, because again, we're talking about school-aged children here, we're doing prepackaged cold meals. However, back to the emergency food relief that we're doing, we are of course including things like cans of soup and things of that nature, trying to make sure that we are having the best and most thoughtful things in there with the lowest sodium counts and things of that nature as well. But again, these are just not normal times, and we have to do everything that we possibly can to make sure that we are getting people any nutrition right now whatsoever.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what it's about. Emergency food, you know, they really need it. And of course, they're, you know, the insecure communities are very often, and this is no exception, the most heavily hit when it comes to pandemics and, you know, different health issues. So
exactly.
Yeah, very important. Anyway, we're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I would love to talk about the Healthy Food Initiative program that you run over at FoodLink. I don't know if it's running right now, but anyway, we can talk about it. Everyone who's listening, don't go anywhere. My guest is Mitch Gruber from FoodLink up in Rochester, and we'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, my guest this week is Mitch Gruber. He is the Chief Strategy Officer at FoodLink, which is a nonprofit food bank organization up in the Rochester Finger Lakes region. So, Mitch, welcome back. Can you tell us about the Healthy Food Initiative program that you run at FoodLink?
I would love to, but I'm actually not sure which initiative you're referring to right now. Are you talking about the Healthy Pantry Initiative?
I guess I was interested in the community kitchen as one of them.
Got you.
Kitchen, you also have a community farm, right?
Yeah. So FoodLink has a number of what we call community health programs. One of them is I've talked about a little bit with our curbside market. We have our kitchen, which does about 5,000 meals a day, usually hot meals for after school feeding programs in and around the city of Rochester. We also have about 10 nutrition educators who go out on a daily basis and help teach the skills of how to cook, shop, and eat healthy on a budget. One of my favorite things, again, thinking about my two roles, both as a city council member and with FoodLink, is we have this incredible resource in Rochester known as the Rochester Public Market, which is one of my favorite places in the whole world. And the public market is amazing for a number of reasons, but one of the coolest is that it is, of all the farmers markets and public markets in the entire nation, it is by far number one in SNAP transactions across the entire nation. It's a really remarkable thing. People come on a weekly basis and use a lot of their SNAP dollars to get tokens and to go out and buy fresh and healthy and local foods. And every single market day, FoodLink has nutrition educators who are there teaching people how to eat, shop, and cook healthy on a budget, specifically folks who utilize SNAP benefits. So, you know, here we are in April. Soon we'll be talking about what to do with things like asparagus, right? And then we'll make sure that it's that every single day or every single week we have something new seasonal going on to really try to help people, again, make the healthy choice the easy choice. And on top of that, we also want to make sure that we're always giving people the skills to be able to grow food. So FoodLink does operate the largest urban farm in Rochester. It's a little over an acre. It's actually in the old subway bed. Rochester is sadly the only city in the nation to have a defunct subway system. And prior to that, it was a little something called the Erie Canal, which I'm sure a lot of folks are familiar with. So here we are in Rochester. We actually have an urban farm in the old Erie Canal. It's a really cool project, and it specifically goes to serve between 60 and 70 refugee families, mostly coming from Nepal and Burma and South Asia. And so we really, again, we have this continuum of services where it's teaching people how to grow food, how to cook food, providing people with the opportunities to buy food, and training people for the skills to be able to actually work in the food industry. And that work is really what makes FoodLink unique in the Feeding America network.
And do you have master gardeners or farmers that are there to help everyone, or do most of these people come in with their own knowledge? I mean, I know I found that a lot here in New York City area. You know, there's with so many of the immigrant communities, they have such a wealth of knowledge, and they have, I mean, you go to some of their community farms and you don't even recognize what some of the vegetables are because they grow so many different varieties that they're used to from their countries. So how does that work at your farm?
Yeah, I think one of the coolest things about it is that there's a lot of knowledge sharing. So we do have a master gardener. We have someone who is really, really skilled in urban agriculture, certainly one of the leaders in our community. We work with extension offices, but the vast majority of the farmers at our Lexington Avenue Community Farm are individuals who have backgrounds in agriculture. And it's really amazing what we learn from them. We obviously can provide some other skills as well. But one of my favorite things about walking through the farm is looking at the trellising. I mean, you look at when I am putting in trellising in my backyard, I use whatever I bought from Home Depot or Lowe's the year before. And, you know, the folks in our farm are making beautiful, ornate, and elaborate homemade trellis out of sticks and other natural materials. And it's really cool, and it's exactly how urban ag should work. It should reflect the diversity of the city.
Uh-huh. And what has brought such a large immigrant population or refugee population to the Rochester area?
It's largely the Catholic Family Center and the Catholic Diocese here is one of the resettlement entities, and have brought in there's a huge amount of refugees and new Americans in both Buffalo and Rochester, and a lot of that is due to the Catholic Diocese. I mean, I think that one of the most troubling parts of the last 3 years of the Trump administration is that we have seen our refugee population in Rochester go down very dramatically as borders have been closed. And I think that's a really sad thing for a variety of reasons, but it's a particularly sad thing for the food system. I mean, the food systems work best when they are, when they're diverse spaces, when they have a lot of different things and different types of expertise coming and different types of flavors and different experiences. And fortunately, we still have a very diverse community here, but I can't wait till we get to have an opportunity where we can, in fact, continue to open up our door to folks from different backgrounds again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes it so rich, you know, right? When you bring in so many different cultures and you have that exchange of food and cultures, and, you know, food just is, you know, is the commonality that brings everyone together. It's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it. Now, you mentioned that at the farmer's market or at the Rochester Public Market, that they accept SNAP. And earlier you had talked about doubling the SNAP benefits. Does Rochester actually double them, or because I think in New York it's just for every $5, I think you get an extra $2. How does it work in Rochester?
Yeah, great question. So the program you're mentioning is called the Fresh Connect program. That's the spend five, get two. And that is in fact what the Rochester Public Market uses. It's what most of the markets in and around Rochester use. Foodlink's curbside market, on the other hand, we are part of a small group of folks who have an opportunity to do the full double up food bucks. And that is through a USDA grant that we received several years ago, along with actually we're a subcontractor with the Field and Fork Network out of Buffalo. And we are able to do full double ups. So you spend five, you get five additional dollars. And right now, one of the things that I'm trying to work on whenever I can is trying to figure out how we can help make this how we can help get the state to make that something that we do for all markets. That is a goal. That is what they've done in states like Michigan, I believe Colorado and New Mexico have it as well.
Yeah,
And I think
again.
there's a huge benefit to doing a traditional one-to-one double up, because what we noticed at the curbside market with this, with the Fresh Connect program, is that it's a wonderful thing. Obviously, it's additional money for folks. But if someone spends $3 or someone spends $4, they're not eligible for an incentive. Whereas we really want to make sure that everyone, regardless of how much they can spend, has some incentive to buy healthy local food.
Right. All of these problems I think will get solved when our government pays the health care bill, because then they'll have incentive to get us all healthy. Right now, it's good business keeping us sick. That's kind of what I say, although, this pandemic might be changing how some people think about this. But in general, there's not the incentive that there should be to make everybody healthy. And that's unfortunate, but I know the Double Up Your Bucks program in Michigan has been very successful at really encouraging people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. And let's
Yeah,
face it.
and again, what I would go back to, sorry to cut you off, Avani, but
Okay.
I know time is short, and I think this is a really important thing just to say. I said it earlier, talking about how the medical community has done a very good job of getting people to think more about their diet, but it doesn't go far enough. And let me draw an analogy and give a couple of different points. One, I would compare this to conversations about smoking cessation that were had before my lifetime in the 60s, or more so in the 70s and even into the 80s, where one of the biggest public health pushes in the whole nation was getting people to stop smoking cigarettes. And there was a huge amount of public support and public pressure being put on to make this happen. And in reality, while I don't mean to minimize for a second the challenge of addiction and things of that nature, but in the end, the decision to stop smoking cigarettes is a decision that someone gets to make on their own. It's something that they themselves have the control to do. The problem with this analogous thing with food access and food and healthy diets is that we can spend all the time in the world telling people to eat healthier. But if in the end, in poor neighborhoods, there is only convenience stores and bodegas, and in wealthy neighborhoods, there is, every single possible product known to man, then we're going to continue to have a problem. And so that's the issue with this public health crisis, is that what we're not realizing is that it's not just convincing people to eat healthy, it is also having them then rely on private businesses that simply do not exist where the folks who need it the most live. And I'll just give you one other point to that puzzle. And this is, I just, as you said to start the show, I just had a baby. I left the hospital after 3 days there, beyond impressed with the nurses and the doctors. I couldn't believe the kind of service that we got. So I hate to throw them under the bus here, but who serves worse food in the entire country than the hospital systems? I can't think of anyone that does. And so we have this problem where the medical community recognizes the importance of diet, but they're not yet really treating food as medicine. And that is something that we desperately need to change, and we need to change in a big way fast.
I agree with you. Couldn't agree quicker. You know, what's so ridiculous is dietitians that people go to all the time to try to help them eat better, and, you know, nutritionists, and, you know, and they're responsible for school food and hospital food. You know, it's pathetic.
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do, but the foundation is laid. I mean, there is no doubt that the foundation has already been laid for improving people's diets, improving diets in this country. We just need to make sure that we're making the right investments, and that is precisely what not to go off on a tangent here, but that's what I wrote my dissertation on, was about the history of food retailers and food retail and the role of government in it. And that's precisely why I decided to run for public office a couple years back, because this is not something that the nonprofit sector can do on its own. It's not something that even the medical sector can do on its own, or that radio shows like this can do on our own. It's something that we need for government and public sector to get involved and say, we need to figure out how to address the looming public health crisis over people's diets. The problem now, Bhavani, is that we have an even bigger public health crisis looming over us as we speak, and I'm hoping that doesn't set us back a couple more years on this stuff.
Yeah, I hope it won't. I mean, who knows, but I really, really hope it doesn't. You know, but people are so preoccupied, understandably so, with the pandemic that so many things are being forgotten about and not being addressed right now, or being snuck through under the table because no one's paying attention. So we all have to, you know, not let up at all and keep paying attention and keep letting our voices be heard. Now, can you explain to my listeners, why aren't there supermarkets like Wegmans or Whole Foods in downtown Rochester? Why are they only in the suburbs?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a particularly complicated answer. There is what I have worked a lot with a lot of grocery companies over the years, and they make very shrewd business decisions on where they should be and when. They have actuaries that figure out what the potential is for what their volume of sales could be, and they go to where there is profit. I mean, and if you look ultimately at the history of retail, it was really this idea of supermarkets that prioritized above anything else, that prioritized not having to go to the store every day, right? That's why the biggest bell or whistle to a supermarket back when they were first opening up in the 40s and 50s was the parking lot. I mean, it was about getting cars there to fill up so that you don't have to keep going shopping every day for your daily sundry. And in the end, what that's meant is that there are supermarkets where there is affluence and where there are real dollars. So, sorry.
You still there?
I am. I'm right here.
Good. Okay.
So the reality is that that's the decision that was made in the 40s and 50s, and it's still the case right now. However, I think there's interesting solutions and interesting interventions. One thing that we at FoodLink are doing is we're actually engaging in a feasibility study right now to develop nonprofit grocery stores in the city of Rochester. I've seen this happen with the Salvation Army in Baltimore, started a nonprofit grocery store. I've seen the Food Bank in Philadelphia open one. There are new models where we can think about food retail without having to think about profit. Because in some ways, if we all recognize that that access to food retail is a real must, then we need to stop thinking about it as a private business and start thinking about it as a public utility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've been hearing about public supermarkets opening, cooperative markets opening in rural areas too, because in the rural areas where the farmers are there growing us the food, they can't support for-profit supermarkets. There's not enough people living there anymore. And so supermarkets don't want to open there, and people just, you know, we're having to drive an hour to get to a supermarket. And so small towns have been working together to form these cooperative supermarkets. And, I've been reading about it, and it sounds, you know, really promising. And
yeah, the mayor of a city or a town called Baldwin down in Florida just opened up a municipally run supermarket. It's a truly remarkable thing, and I think we're going to see more and more of this. And FoodLink, again, we've just embarked on a feasibility study that we think is going to lead us to the opportunity to open up some really good, innovative models for grocery.
Uh-huh. So we're almost out of time. Can you share with my listeners how they would find out more information about FoodLink, and also how does your funding work? Are you looking for contributions from the public, or are you all grant based? How does that work?
Yeah, individuals can go to foodlinkny.org. That's foodlinkny.org, and can always send me an email directly. Just look me up on the FoodLink website, Mitch Gruber. And we always have prided ourselves on having a very diverse funding stream. We have state support, we have private support, we have grants, and we have some social enterprises, which I've talked about. So, of course, we always want people who are interested in investing in healthy futures to get in touch, and we'd love to talk through that. But in the end, the most important thing is if anyone's interested in the work we're doing, and the mission that we have to be in touch to talk through it further.
And I have one last question. As the Farm to School Coordinator, how can our school get your apples? Are they available downstate?
Yes, absolutely. We work with distributors who get them throughout the entire state and beyond, and we will continue to scale up. So, again, that's something that we can discuss, and I can easily make that happen for you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us. It's been such a great, informative time, and I want to also thank you. Even in light of having a baby this week, you're still getting out there and providing emergency food for those that need it. Really,
it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Let's do it again sometime when the world returns to normal.
Wonderful. Have a nice Passover virtually.
You too.
And everyone listening, have a wonderful holiday this week. Check out the matzo ball recipe that I shared earlier. You can find it online, and let me know how you like it. Have a great rest of the week. Happy holidays, and see you all again next week. Bye for now.